Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This week on Radio Curious, I want to extend an invitation to you to meet two remarkable Americans. On Friday evening of this week, May 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the Unity Church in Ukiah. That's at the corner of Henry and Bush Streets, about two blocks from the Ukiah Post Office. Julius Margolin and George Mann, two men separated in age by almost 46 years, are what might be called traveling troubadours who carry the message of working people in song and spirit. They'll present an evening of history in labor songs and social activism in a program that is not to be missed. I met with George and Julius in the studios of Radio Curious a few months ago, and I asked them about their background, their ideas, and their songs. Julius begins our conversation by telling us about his experience in the 1930s as a labor organizer.
Yes, I was active. My trade union activity and understanding took place 1934 during the Big Depression.
What was your trade? What union were you a member of?
Oh my God, so many. The Food Workers Industrial Union, which was not affiliated with the AFL at the time, there was no CIO at the time, was the first union I came into, and that's where I learned a great deal about organizing. It was progressive and left-led by young people like myself, and I was young in those days.
What do you mean progressive and left-led?
Very militant. Organizers who took chances in organizing, who were not afraid of employers, and being young and vibrant, they were very active and militant.
When you say they took chances in organizing, what kind of chances?
Well, the employers in those days, many of them, had goon squads against labor organizers.
For some people who may not know what a goon squad is, can you explain?
Thugs.
What did they do?
They beat up and in a number of cases even killed organizers and active workers, militant workers. So organizing the CIO, and that's what I was involved in at the time, from a little after 1934 onwards, I'm still organizing.
Can you explain what CIO is?
Yes, the Congress of Industrial Organizations came into being because in the Executive Council of the old AFL, only skilled workers generally were organized by the AFL at that time, but the millions of unorganized, low-paid workers in the mass production industries were not. In other words, there was very little in auto, very little amongst electricians, electrical workers, very little organization in transportation except for the railroads, you name the low-paid industries, and there was practically no organization.
What was the average pay at that time?
Oh, all right, I'll tell you what I got when I first started. I was a busboy in the cafeteria. That's what we organized, the whole cafeteria in the industry in New York City. And we worked a 60-hour week. No pay for overtime. If the employer worked the overtime, he didn't necessarily have to pay anything, and didn't, generally. And the women who were doing the same work that I was in the cafeterias, here I am, I'm getting $10.50 for a 60-hour week, and these women doing the same hard work that I did only got $9 a week.
For a 60-hour week?
For a 60-hour week. And that's not counting whenever the boss wanted you to work overtime without pay.
How often was that?
Quite often. The bosses had their way at that time.
So tell us about your organizing techniques and what you were able to do.
Well, there were many organizing techniques. Let me give you one technique in the cafeteria industry. We used to go into the cafeterias during their busiest periods. We were young, so we'd pair up a young man and a young boy and a young woman during their busiest periods, which were generally the weekends when families came in to have their meals and so forth. We'd come in and occupy as many of the tables as we could, and we'd just order coffee, and we'd sit, and we'd sit, and we'd sit, and the employer didn't know who was a true customer and who was not.
That's similar to the tactics that were used in the early 60s in desegregating the lunch counters in the South.
I would say so. We sort of started it.
So what was your success rate like?
Oh, we organized an unorganized industry in New York City. And that section, which was generally organized, was mafia-dominated. So we not only had to fight the employers, we had to fight the mafia goons.
In the example that you've given, could you feel something happen before the workers agreed to be organized and could overcome the pressure from the employers?
It was very difficult. There was a great deal of violence, and of course labor was blamed for the violence, but it was generally initiated by the employer, and often we had to defend ourselves by violent means. That wasn't general. The method generally was, we'd make contact with workers whom we felt might be receptive to union organization, and we'd take them to a gin mill or even visit them in the home and have discussions with them. But before that took place, there would be a long period of feeling people out, because we didn't want to jeopardize their jobs. Because if the employer found out that they were trying to organize a union, they'd have no job.
George Mann, can you tell us how you and Julius met?
Well, I met Julius at the Great Labor Arts Exchange in 1996. We were both attending for the first time. It's an annual gathering of labor and folk artists. And found out that he lived in New York City, where I live also. Coincidentally, that also his local was right next door on the same block as my union, where I was working for the Musicians Union. And he used to stop in after that first meeting in 96. We'd see him once in a while, started going out, bringing him out for beers. We should make clear that there's about 45 years between us. Julius is 86 and I'm 40. And I guess the defining moment was in 1998 when Julius almost died. He had a blood clot in his leg. And he put him in the hospital for 3 weeks and took him a good month or two to get back to regular for him, which is very active. And at that point, I started thinking, boy, this boy's not getting any younger. He's writing songs. He wants to do music. And I proposed the idea of trying to work together. I was so enamored of a man who at that time was about 79, 80, and that he was writing songs. Julius almost died in 98. He was very sick for a few weeks, and we was very touchy with that. You know, that blood clot almost killed him. I just felt it was so important to get his story out and to develop his songs and to use my ability as a producer, as a musician who had been making albums and recording songs for a long time, to develop his work. So it's, in a way, it not only helped me to see a new way of looking at music, but also I started realizing that there were so many great and important topics to write about. You know, your standard rock and roll fare is I love you, you love me, I left you, you left me. You know, it's so important to write songs about events and historical events and struggle. And so it changed my whole focus over those couple years as we started working together about how I saw myself as a writer and a musician.
Julius, for you to write a song, what goes into that effort?
I think it's very difficult. I imagine it's very difficult for all songwriters to write a song. But my main emphasis and my main outlook is struggle of the people for security, for peace, and a decent life. That basically is it. And especially the young people, they have a future that could very well be dismal. And the more they learn about the struggles of life and the hardships and what some of us have learned in regard to organizing to make a better life for everyone, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. There is no reason whatsoever that there should be poverty over the world. There's so much wealth in the world that if it were organized equitably, could support the families all over the world with peace and security. And that's what I strive for.
Tell us about your favorite song. What's the one that comes first to mind?
There are really so many, but almost anything that Woody Guthrie wrote is amongst my favorites. And of course, Pete Seeger and Lead Belly. You know, it was very sad. He wrote Irene Goodnight. And died before he got the rewards for it, when it became number one on the hit parade. And it's extremely, extremely sad. So that's the type of working class and civil rights and social music that I'm interested in playing. So that almost any of the songs I love.
Is there one of your favorite songs that the two of you could sing for us?
Woody Guthrie's Hard Traveling. I've been having some hard traveling. I thought you knowed. I've been having some hard traveling way down the road. I've been having some hard traveling, hard rambling, hard gambling. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. I've been working in a hard rock mine, I thought you knowed. I've been laying on a pressure drill way down the road. Hammers flying, air hose sucking, 6 feet of mud and I've been a-mucking. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. I've been laying in a hard rock jail, I thought you knowed. I've been laying out 90 days way down the road. Damn old judge said to me, 90 days for vagrancy. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. I've been doing some hard traveling, I thought you knowed. Oklahoma to Kansas City, way down the road. Shucking that corn, stacking that hay, trying to earn about a dollar a day. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. I've been walking that Lincoln Highway, I thought you knowed. I've been walking old 66, way down the road. Heavy load, worried mind, looking for a gal that's hard to find. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. I've been having some hard traveling, I thought you knowed. I've been having some hard traveling way down the road. I've been having some hard traveling, hard rambling, hard gambling. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord.
This week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Julius Margolin and George Mann, who will be presenting a program of folk music and labor songs on Friday evening of this week, May 9th, at 7:30 p.m. at the Unity Church in Ukiah, at the corner of Henry and Bush Streets, about two blocks from the Ukiah Post Office. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Julius, is there a favorite song of yours that you've written that maybe you could sing for us?
Oh, let me see. I've just written it, and it's going to be on a new album. Yeah, I don't know how great a song it is, but it's certainly appropriate. called Enron. I was so angry at the steel and at those who were said that they were going to correct it. There's no correction taking place, and there won't be any, because the SEC was in cahoots with this gang of thieves, and as far as I know, it still is. So I wrote the song Enron. And as you know, the Bush family got a bribe of almost $1 million for their election campaign from Enron. They had very close contact with Lay and others. And they're up to their necks in not only in the Enron swindle, but Halliburton, Cheney and Halliburton. That whole gang are up to their necks in the swindle. And nobody's went to jail, and I fear that nobody will, because there isn't the type of anger and outcry there should be. So I wrote the song, and it's on the album. George did a beautiful job, I think, of making it sound better than it will in its raw state. And it's called Enron. Enron, Enron, Bush corporate thieves, what other swindles are up your sleeves? You lie and you steal, but you can't get away. So you change the evidence by night and by day. Enron, Enron, Bush corporate thieves, what other swindles are up your sleeves? Millions of workers not in the know, losing their savings, a criminal blow. Their 401ks fell 100 or 2. They call this a pension. I say we got screwed. Enron, WorldCom, Bush corporate thieves, what other swindles are up your sleeves? The George Bush gang knew in advance, so they could unload and not take a chance. They stole many billions while workers got nailed. The Enron Bush swindlers must go to jail. Enron, WorldCom, Bush corporate thieves, what other swindles are up your sleeves? Enron, WorldCom, Bush corporate thieves, what other swindles are up your sleeves? And war is one of them.
Before you put your guitar away,
yes,
or too far away, how about another one?
Okay, could we sing, let's see, maybe I'll sing one of the new ones? Like, yeah. Beautiful Child or something? I need to grab the cable.
Oh, that's a beautiful song. Beautiful, Beautiful Child is a beautiful song. But George,
tell us about it.
Well, George will explain it and how he came to write it, you know. And I think it's beautiful because it also deals with some of the problems that we all have to go through, and especially children and what the future that faces them. So George does a beautiful job on it, I think.
I wrote this for my friends who had their first baby almost 2 years ago, and I was trying to write a song that would just celebrate the birth of the child. But then 9/11 intervened, and it took me about 6 months to get back to finishing the song. And when I finally came around to finishing it last summer, it was in the aftermath of the bombing and attacks in Afghanistan, you know, in response to 9/11. And I just felt that we need to make the statement that a child is beautiful no matter what country that child lives in, no matter where its parents are from, and that when we drop bombs in Iraq and other places and kill men and women, that's somebody's father or mother we're killing. So our hope, my hope is that we could start, it's kind of utopian, but that we make that commitment that new children will not live in misery and horrible conditions that they live in now. She holds the blanket close against her baby's tiny head,
sign of her devotion to the life within her hands. She sings to him, sings with the fullness of her faith. Faith in the potential of humanity and grace. The world is full of love. The world is full of hate. Maybe we could all agree, start over today. This beautiful child shall not know hunger. This beautiful child shall not know hate. This beautiful child shall not see war or man's intolerance or make the same mistakes we made. Clock and he's lying with a baby in his bed. The little wolf stops crying and the dreams enter his head. He sings now, sings like a daddy only can. In Quebec, Iraq, the USA, or in Afghanistan. The world is full of love. The world is full of hate. But maybe we could all agree to start over today. This beautiful child shall not know hunger. This beautiful child shall not know hate. This beautiful child shall not see war or man's indifference or make the same mistakes we made. Or make the same mistakes we made. This beautiful child, so full of wonder, sees only love, knows only joy. So we must vow that we will all walk with these children to build a world that's better than we find it now, and work to see this child won't be let down. And work to see this child won't be let down. And work to see this child won't be let down.
George, what do you seek to affect by bringing music and culture and songs in the struggle for workers' rights?
Well, I think it's very important that this element exists and should be utilized more. Not just in labor organizing, but in all organizing. I mean, the value and power of a good song, of getting people singing, is so much better than endless speeches and endless dialogue about the struggle. We also think it's very important, because we see this, that our activists are aging and there's very few replacing them. We need to bring youth into the movement, and song is one way to do it. It may not be the kind of music or the style of music that most of the young kids are listening to these days, but it's something that's so important that singing can help. We, Julius and I, had a great experience a few years ago working with the Union Summer Contingent. It's an annual internship that the AFL-CIO does for young kids, you know, college-age kids, and we were on a picket line for 3 weeks working with these kids. Writing parodies against a restaurant chain, the Cipriani family, that had taken over the Rainbow Room, a very famous restaurant in New York City. And that those workers had been locked out. The new owners came in and locked out the union and said, "We don't need you. We have no obligation to hire you or adhere to a union contract." And they'd been on the line for 3 or 4 months at the time that we got involved with this union summer thing. And those workers were tired. They were beaten down. They were losing heart. And to see 20, 30 kids out there singing songs, parodies that we'd written against the boss about what a rat the boss was, really gave them spirit and raised them up. And the great thing was that 2 or 3 weeks after the internship program ended and we'd all gone, the company settled.
George, what's your background?
Well, I came out of Stony Brook College, the University of Stony Brook.
On Long Island.
Yes, New York's SUNY State University, New York. And I was a journalist and an editor and you know, got my master's degree in English. But it was during my graduate studies that this battle for 7 years had been going on to unionize teaching assistants in SUNY. And I got involved in it along the way. And fortunately for me, the year I got my master's was the year that the court battle ended, that we won the right to unionize. And the Communication Workers of America was the union that was standing behind these 4,000 graduate student teachers and hired me and a number of other people as an organizer for that campaign. We won 85% of the vote in December 1992 and got the union in for 4,000 teaching assistants. And that started me on my career union organizing. I did 5 years with the Musicians Union in New York City, worked with SEIU and CWA a little along the way, and right now just doing music full-time with Julius and having a lot of fun.
Where did you first get your music training?
Well, I played cello and guitar in school, you know, in elementary and junior high school, and that's where I got my formal training. But like most folk players, I'm mostly by ear and mostly self-taught. You know, certainly I had lessons along the way, but with a good ear and a little bit of study, you certainly can learn most of what's out there in the folk canon.
George Mann and Julius Margolin, I want to thank you both for joining us on Radio Curious. I'd like to ask you each the closing question. Can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I love Michael Moore, whatever he writes.
And George, your book?
Well, this was a book I read on purpose. I read it for research on a song, and it's going to be on our new album. The song is called Great White Father. The book I read was called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown, and coincidentally, it was just so amazing. I finished the book right around Thanksgiving. I wrote the song December 5th, and Dee Brown died December 6th, I think, or 7th.
George Mann and Julius Margolin, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay, thanks, Barry. Best wishes to you.
George Mann and Julius Margolin will present a program of folk music and labor songs this Friday evening, May 9th, at 7:30 p.m. at the Unity Church in Ukiah, at the corner of Henry and Bush Streets, about two blocks from the Ukiah Post Office. The books Julius recommends are any of those written by Michael Moore. George recommends Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. Here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-7222.